The Pulse nightclub shooting highlights a flaw in the U.S. healthcare system. The closest hospital gets the most patients in a mass casualty incident. I'm Abe Barbaria, and you're listening to a special documentary from WMFE in Orlando. This is Pulse, Chaos in the ER.
I mean, yeah, I was thinking I could get shot, but I'm going to continue to care for these people.
We didn't have a sheet to cover up a patient that was deceased that was just going to go be lined up with other bodies.
In this hour, we'll bring you the unvarnished story from healthcare workers about what happened during the Pulse nightclub shooting. We'll talk to doctors and nurses about the first wave of patients, how they cared for families desperate to find loved ones, and how Orlando's shooting helped mold the healthcare response in Las Vegas. And a warning for young listeners, this documentary airs audio from police body cameras and 911 calls. You're listening to Pulse, Chaos in the ER from WMFE in Orlando after a short break. Orlando Regional Medical Center is the busiest trauma center in Florida and one of the busiest in the country. Even with all that experience, ORMC was flooded with victims in the chaos after Omar Mateen opened fire inside Pulse nightclub. Victims were brought by police trucks and cruisers and brought themselves, bypassing ambulances. 36 victims with multiple gunshot wounds in the first 36 minutes. There were 32 staff members in the emergency department when it started. That means it's possible there were more patients than staff before the hospital called in 19 more people. In total, ORMC got 44 shooting victims. 9 of them died.
What is the location of your emergency?
Shooting a pool. I'm there. They're shooting. Active shooting a pool. They're shooting. They're like, oh my God.
Okay, stay on the phone with me. Don't hang up. Do you know what's another cross street there?
It's next to the hospital.
3 blocks down the road, staff members at Orlando Regional Medical Center didn't know what kind of patients they were going to get or how many. Libby Brown is a nurse in the ORMC ER.
And then I got a text from my husband, who's an Orlando City fireman, and he said that we were going to get multiple victims from the vicinity of Pulse. He was like, you guys are going to get busy.
Libby's friend Liz Burrows works with her in the ER. She remembers those first few patients that came through the door.
And everybody was really calm. Shell-shocked.
Yeah, pretty quiet, actually.
You mean the patients?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, it was eerie because they had massive wounds. I mean, these are not the gunshot wounds we are used to seeing. Mm-hmm. And, like, what was told to me later by Orlando police was that the caliber of gun that was used was just much bigger than what they're used to seeing, you know. Mm-hmm. And it did a lot of damage. So it was surprising to see how calm they were. But then they just started rolling in so quickly. And then the ones that came in deceased, I mean, it just kind of took us all. I know I was in shock because everybody was so young, you know.
Dr. Chad Smith was a trauma surgeon working that night.
Yeah, so the first patient came in, and he actually, you know, he was shot in the abdomen, and he was stable, complaining of belly pain. And then you know, ordinarily, if it was just him, he would go straight to the operating room.
But this wasn't an ordinary night.
The second patient that came in was dying, and we did a couple of, you know, placed a tube in his chest to improve with no improvement, and I mean, he was literally dying. We did an incision, you know, an incision in his chest to try to save his life, but he ultimately died.
An incision in his chest, maybe the most understated description of what was done. At the bedside, they did what's called a resuscitative thoracotomy.
I mean, it's a incision in the chest where you open the chest and clamp the aorta and you know, massage the heart if you need to, or evacuate blood if you need to. But the inside his chest cavity, the bullet had just kind of, you know, done its damage to his spine, his aorta, his, you know, so there was no way to save him.
Nurses Libby Brown and Liz Burrows remember that patient.
Patient they just started the thoracotomy on.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody was, I think that's like the most traumatizing, one of the most traumatizing things that people remember, I guess, was that.
There was an attempt to try to save one of the victims that came in, and it was, it was just a very intense scene to watch because Dr. Corso worked so hard to try to save him, and he just was not going to live. And so you look over at one point, and he's just agonally breathing.
At this point, the idea of triage came into clear focus.
So he had cut from one end of his ribcage to the other, mm-hmm. to try to visually see where the bleed was to try to stop the bleed. And at that point, that's when Dr. Smith, the attending on that night, stopped him to let him know, like, that we've got to use our resources in
appropriately.
The, and I cannot give them enough credit as far as having the sound mind to systematically stop and triage and assess every patient to figure out what do we do with this patient and do it quickly.
Mm-hmm. Assertive and calm, maybe the words others use to describe Dr. Chad Smith that morning, but that's not how he remembers it. On the inside?
I thought to myself, what? I don't know what I'm going to do, right? Inside, I panicked. They tell me I didn't look panicked, but, inside, I was like, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do with all these people? And so, I just kind of set about doing. I mean, you can sit in the corner and cry, or you can just start. You got to start somewhere.
Now, I want to stop for a second and address something a little bit basic, triage. For most people, triage means healthcare is not on a first-come, first-served basis. At some point in your life, you've probably been sitting in an ER and seen someone walk in after you and get seen sooner. It's an inconvenience, but for most of us, that's all triage will ever be. During an incident like Pulse, triage is different. On any other day, a patient comes in with multiple gunshot wounds and is dying. They'll have a team of literally 20-plus nurses, doctors, respiratory therapists doing everything possible. CPR isn't like the movies. People don't stop after 30 seconds and say he's gone. CPR can last 30 minutes, an hour, longer. Patients are brought to surgery, given machines to breathe, drugs to force your heart to pump. Modern medicine is almost too good at keeping people alive. But when your hospital is overrun with a mass casualty incident, triage means doing the most good for the most people. That means you stop care on those who aren't going to make it. Paramedics do this during war. Most healthcare workers are never going to have to make these kinds of calls.
Well, and that's...
Here's Dr. Smith again.
When you realize that a patient is not going to be able to be saved, any care beyond that point is potentially taking resources and physician effort, supplies from another patient that we can save. And so you have to be able to go from doing the maximum amount of things for one person to doing the using limited resources to save as many people as possible.
And had you ever had to do that before?
Well, we trained to do that, in our disaster drills, not in reality. No.
Dr. Chad Smith called everyone who was on call that night, literally every trauma surgeon. That included Dr. Michael Cheatham, who drove through the police roadblocks for Pulse to get to the hospital that night.
When I entered the emergency department, the first thing I saw was gurneys lined up. And I saw these gurneys lined up in the hallway outside of our what we call our trauma bay, which is where we take care of the sickest patients. And the first thing I saw was a pair of beige high heels protruding from underneath a sheet, which was obviously one of the first victims who had died. And that was unusual. I've never seen that before. And so I continued on past that and into the trauma bay to where it was quite busy.
This was clearly worse than anything he'd seen in 21 years as a surgeon. He asked Dr. Smith what needed to be done and immediately took a patient to the operating room who'd been shot in the back. That surgery went quick, and he let one of the surgical residents finish up with the patient. His second patient was critically wounded. He didn't wait to call up to the operating room.
So that patient was in profound shock when he arrived. He had multiple gunshot wounds to the chest and abdomen. He was actively bleeding. We got in the elevator, and... His heart stopped while we were in the elevator. As I said, it's only two floors. It's a very quick ride. It's a fast elevator. And so we immediately began CPR. As the elevator doors opened, we were rushing down the hallway to the operating room. Got him into a room, continued CPR. Sandy Mukherjee was trying to give him drugs to get his heart started. I was pumping on his chest. but it became rapidly apparent that, that he was not going to be able to survive. And at that point, we had to make a difficult decision because we knew we had so many people downstairs that were bleeding. And so there are certain things that we can look at in vital signs and the like that, that tell us whether somebody has a chance to recover or not. And he just had no blood flow at all and was not responding to anything that we did as we had pumped on his chest and given him several rounds of drugs. And so we went ahead and stopped CPR because it was clear that he was not going to be able to survive. I went back downstairs.
This kind of triage has weighed on many of the healthcare workers since Pulse, especially those who had to make the calls in the heat of the moment. 9 patients died at ORMC. Did they make the right call? Those autopsies showed the 9 people had catastrophic wounds, and they came to a level 1 trauma center, the best place for them to get care. But know this, those 9 faces are burned in the minds of the people working that night. Dr. Cheatham again.
It was a difficult decision and one that we don't normally have to obviously make when we only have 1 or 2 gunshot wounds come in because we can spend quite a bit of time.
One thing that made Pulse such a deadly disaster, the weapon of choice. Nurses Libby Brown and Liz Burrows say the wounds were unmistakable.
They were just so big, too. Like, usually, you know, we'll be rolling people and we'll be looking for, you know, wounds. You didn't have to look. It was obvious where people were injured with most of the patients because it was just humongous.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no way you could miss them. You didn't have to look for any entrance or exit wounds or anything like that.
Yeah.
They were just like gaping large areas that I was like, I remember thinking like, what could do this? Like it didn't really dawn on me because I kept thinking like, oh, I know they're gunshot wounds, but I kept thinking what would be able to do this to someone that would be that big. So.
Yeah.
What could do that was a Sig Sauer MCX. This is a semi-automatic assault weapon. Dr. Josh Kors has a unique perspective on this. He was the chief resident on the trauma surgery team the night of the shooting, but he was also a paramedic in the U.S. Army who was deployed to Kosovo.
Unfortunately, we are seeing more and more of these assault rifle-type injuries. We had another AR-15 shooting last week. And again, this goes back a lot to my military experience. The AR-15, it's called either the 223 round or the 5.56, is basically just a very high-powered .22. And people that know what that is, it's one of the smallest bullets available. And where it does its damage isn't necessarily in the size of the round, but the amount of energy behind it. It's a very, very fast-moving round. It moves like 3,000 feet per second. So the entrance wound is really a centimeter or less. It's very small and very easy to miss, which is why we have to examine the patient so closely. The exit wound, however, is massive, anywhere from fist size or larger. And the amount of damage it does through that shockwave as it travels through the body is catastrophic. And those are injuries we do not see a lot. It's so much more devastating than a handgun round.
And my understanding, too, from what I was sort of researching on this, is that when the bullet hits, it then starts to, like, flip inside, and that just adds to everything.
It does. It's a phenomenon called tumbling, if you will. As the bullet starts to meet resistance, depending on where it is, it will kind of pivot on that axis of resistance. So, for instance, if it hits a bone, the back end is going to swing around and it's going to continue to tumble end over end through the body. That create both the large shockwave that I talked about as well as direct tissue damage from this large tumbling piece of metal going through the body.
If you talk to enough of the workers at ORMC that night, one word comes up over and over again.
Such chaos going on.
Chaos. That's Nurse Liz Burrows again, talking with her co-worker Libby Brown.
You keep using the word, but that's really what it was.
But we work under like constant chaos, but it was just a different kind of. It was just completely different because there was you didn't know what was going to happen next, kind of thing. It felt like, you know, we were working so hard, but it felt like we were still just kind of like so helpless because there wasn't enough hands and there weren't, you know, enough doctors. And And we did the best, absolute best that we could, but it still felt like you just felt very helpless because we were just so inundated so quickly trying to reorganize and make sure everything was done and, you know, make sure you were doing everything possible for the patients that did come in that were alive.
At this point, the ER was running out of resources.
I just remember looking at other nurses and, like, at this point, we, like Liz said, we were just out of resources, just seeing nurses just standing at the top of the bed, just squeezing blood products into people because we have pressure, you know, level one pressure machines that will push blood in faster. We have pressure bags that will help push blood in faster. But obviously, those were all kind of
being utilized.
So you see nurses standing at the head of the bed just squeezing blood into people.
Yeah.
So you have nurses, you know, running upstairs, banging on the blood bank door, you know, to go get more blood to bring down and that kind of thing. So once we got, you know, more critical patients stabilized and we were coming out looking at these other patients, we're like, this guy needs to come into the trauma room. He has, you know, a gunshot wound to the abdomen and he's been laying in the nurse's station for a while. We should probably check his vitals and bring him back in there. I mean, but it was just, it was out of necessity because of the level of injury and that kind of thing that we had with the patients. So,
because it got to a point where you weren't even sure if you were helping. There was so much running around and so much chaos that we figured we'd start kind of triaging, reassessing patients. You know, they were triaged when they initially came in, put where we thought their care would best be suited. But there was so many coming at some point that there were people with gunshot wounds to the chest sitting in the hallway, you know, gaping wounds where they're sitting on the floor because we don't have stretchers. So we kind of systematically went through and started trying to figure out how could we best help these people. And then at that point, you kind of like have tunnel vision.
And one of the things you'd mentioned that I hadn't thought about, and I'm not sure if this is maybe more common than I would think, but you'd mentioned that the patients who didn't make it were still there. Is that normal? I would imagine normally if someone's, you know, passed away that, you know, you're getting the medical examiner and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, things happening that aren't being able to be done right then.
Yeah, well, I mean, and too, it was quick thinking as far as we've got to figure out where to
put the bodies.
So they ended up taking them out to where our decon area is outside the double doors. I mean, part of it, too, is thinking about the resources for the next batch of patients coming in. We were running out of stretchers.
Yeah, you had to move people.
So, I mean, as bad as you felt that we were doing this, it was what made the most sense for the situation, you know. So that was a little surreal, too.
I remember, like, a realization, too, when we were in the trauma room, when we had gotten to the point where it was more very beginning, very, like, militaristic style of triage, and we were running out of things, and we had a deceased patient. And Liz is like, I don't have a sheet to cover this patient up with. So I was like, this is really bad. Like, we don't even have, you know, enough to kind of, I mean, we ended up figuring something out, but I remember thinking, this is not a good thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was, like, kind of surreal, as she would say, like, you know, we didn't have a sheet to cover up a patient that was deceased that was just going to go be lined up with other bodies.
And if all that wasn't bad enough, things managed to get worse.
Okay, now we get a second seat at RMC. You may want to come on in. The shooter's at RMC.
Coming up after a short break, Chapter 2, Code Silver at Orlando Regional Medical Center. I'm Abe Abaraya, and you're listening to a special documentary from WMFE in Orlando. This is Pulse, Chaos in the ER. Chapter 2, Code Silver in the ER. No one is exactly sure why the call happened. Maybe someone heard the shots being fired three blocks down the road and thought it was happening at the hospital. Maybe one of the patients panicked. Regardless of why it happened, at 3:19 a.m., the call came out. There was a shooter inside the ER at Orlando Regional Medical Center. Officer James Highland had been cleared to get out of the club by the SWAT team. He was standing by a black F-150 that officers used to transport victims from Pulse to the hospital.
And then that's when I heard over the radio that there was shots fired at the hospital down the street. Instinctively, I threw whatever I had in my hand inside the truck, don't know where it landed at. Jumped in, waited for people to sort of jump in. I know somebody jumped in the passenger side, and there was people in the bed of my truck. I honestly didn't even look in my rearview mirror or my side view mirror to see if they were set in there. I just took off. There's somebody was trying to get up in the truck, and I just sort of left them in the dust.
In the body cam video, it takes Highland less than a minute to get to the hospital. Police approach on foot and see two people running away from them.
Who are they?
Things calm down a little bit, but police officers begin following a trail of blood.
I need to get to him because we're following his blood trail. We don't know if it's a bad guy or not. So I need you to tell me where he's at because we need to go see him. I'm gonna go find him.
As police are walking through the halls with their guns drawn, you can see healthcare workers walking the halls as well. Eventually, the blood trail leads them to the sixth floor. The victim has been shot in the foot. He has a chin beard, like Omar Mateen, which is enough for police to keep him handcuffed while he's being treated. Dr. Gary Parrish is the medical director of the ORMC ER.
I think you have to understand that we knew that there was a tremendous amount of violence going on very close to our department. And it is not unusual for violence and gunmen to make their way to healthcare facilities, hospitals. And furthermore, in hospitals, it tends to be emergency departments where active shooter situations will tend to occur.
Nurses Liz Burrows and Libby Brown.
If you ask me what the worst part of the night was, it was that moment. Far, yeah. Because it kind of puts everything into perspective. But I think it was at some point when we saw commotion there was police officers coming in with guns drawn, and they were telling us to hide.
There's a bit of irony here, too. Both nurses had been made to watch a video on what to do during an active shooter situation, and neither of them did what the video told them to do.
Well, I remember us looking for each other.
Yeah, because Liz was on the other side, and I screamed her name because I was like, oh, my gosh. Like, I guess for some reason in my head, okay, maybe she didn't hear this large page overhead that there is an active shooter.
I saw the cops before I heard anything overhead.
Oh, I didn't. I just heard that overhead, and I was like, so I screamed for Liz.
Libby hid in a patient's room.
I remember how scared I was being in there, like when I went into the patient's room before Liz got in there, like I shut the door, and then I just remember being in there by myself, and the patient, he was kind of like half awake, half asleep.
Half intoxicated.
Speaking only Spanish. I'm trying with my limited Spanish to get him to calm down. and then I'm sitting there and I'm like, I'm all by myself. Like, I was, like, really scared.
It was scary.
Yeah, I wanted somebody else in there. So I was so glad when Liz, like, came to the door. I was like, yes, please come in here with me.
Over in the trauma bay, Dr. Michael Cheatham had an idea.
I told everybody to go ahead and barricade the doors. We have big portable x-ray machines that probably weigh hundreds of pounds. And so we pushed those up against the doors to block them. And I said, okay, let's get back to the patients.
I'm trying to think how you would describe one of these things.
Dr. Josh Corsa.
It's really just a large rolling box, probably about 3 feet by 2 feet. It weighs a ton. It's got its own motor in it for pushing around, and it's certainly not something you're going to force out of the way with any human. That would probably take a bobcat or a bulldozer to move that thing.
Now, we should be perfectly clear here. There was no shooter at Orlando Regional Medical Center, but in that moment, people working there didn't know that.
I mean, yeah, I was thinking I could get shot, but I'm going to continue to care for these people, and we're going to do what we can.
Dr. Chad Smith again.
And I really had thought about it. I mean, I thought about, I want to say that happened in maybe half a second. I thought about my wife. I thought about my kids. I thought about God. I thought about, well, if this is it, this is it, but I'm not going to leave these people.
And Smith wasn't the only one who thought about loved ones in that moment.
I remember seeing people maybe texting their loved ones. I remember specifically thinking, you know, I texted my partners, don't come to the emergency department, because I remember thinking, oh my gosh, there's somebody here with a gun. I've called them all here, and now I'm going to be responsible for potentially them, you know, getting shot. So, I mean, that I want to say that lasted 30 or 40 minutes. I think if you go by the timeline, it seemed quick, and then also it seemed slow, because you're really thinking about that. And ultimately, it turned out that that's not the case, but that still, it doesn't take away those kind of feelings that I think everybody has had. That is what's been the most kind of difficult, I think, for most of the team members.
Smith says caregivers have an obligation in moments like this.
I mean, you literally think a bullet could come through that door right now and you'd be dead. But, and of course, for the people that we're caring for, that did happen, right? But, I mean, you know, as a caregiver, I think you're obligated to, you know, you can't just abandon your patients because, and nobody did. I mean, you know, you're obligated to care for the people that can't care for themselves. And, you know, if you become one of those people in that stead, then, I mean, I guess that's a risk of your, you know, that you take.
Having the door barricaded shut did pose some problems. They couldn't get patients in and out of the trauma bay.
You know, I tell the story of one of our interns that took a patient to the operating room during the code silver, and this patient was dying, and she rolled the patient out there, you know, and did her job to take the patient to the operating room thinking that she could be shot, you know, and not just in the trauma bay, but rolling down the hall, into the elevator, et cetera.
And that's just one story among many. Dr. Michael Cheatham again.
I was amazed by how many of our team members literally came out of the rooms that they had originally been told to barricade in and went back to taking care of patients. And I was very proud of everybody for doing that. They put, you know, all the victims ahead of their own safety. You know, we didn't know whether, as we turned a corner, there would be a gunman there. But we knew that we had victims that needed to be cared for.
Like so many things about Pulse, the ripples from this incident reverberate outside the core group affected. Take nurse Libby Brown. Remember, her husband's the firefighter working that night. He texted her there had been a shooting and that they were about to get busy.
And it occurred to me, too, that, you know, with your husband being in fire rescue, I mean, did he know that there was a call for this?
Yes, and he was actually at the scene of Pulse when it went over the police tag that there was an active shooter ORMC. So during the whole situation, I didn't look at my phone like the entire time. And then that morning I look at it, there's like 10 texts. Get out of there, there's an active shooter. You've got to get out, you've got to get out of there. And I'm like, oh, like, should have probably. So he was very scared.
It took 45 minutes to clear Orlando Regional Medical Center. At this point, Omar Mateen told police he had a bomb. Police breached the nightclub and brought a second, smaller round of patients to Orlando Regional Medical Center. During all this, one thing the hospital wasn't prepared for, the hundreds of family members who arrived desperate for news about their loved ones.
I could hear the screaming, the blood-curdling screaming every time they would pull someone into another room next to my office and tell them that they were dead.
Chapter 3, What About Mine, coming up after a short break. I'm Abe Abariah, and you're listening to a special documentary from WMFE in Orlando. This is Pulse, Chaos in the ER. Chapter 3, But What About Mine? Holly Stewart is the Director of Patient Experience for Orlando Health. That means it's her job to make your stay at the hospital more pleasant, a difficult experience normally, an impossible task June 12th. When she got to the hospital that morning, she saw something unusual.
And you could see a crowd of people being held outside. The hospital was under lockdown. And there were, you know, it looked like hundreds of people waiting outside. And I remember thinking that was unusual. I think the more unusual thing to me was I walked by the front desk where normally we would have a guest service team member there managing it, and there was a law enforcement officer I didn't recognize, and he was dressed in SWAT gear, and he had a really intimidating-looking machine gun. I don't know guns well, but it was not your typical thing that you see in the hospital, and so I knew right then that it was going to be a really unusual day.
Orlando health officials decided to bring all the family members into the hospital into a big conference room. Stuart remembers what the room was like.
It is tense. You know, people have been woken up in the middle of the night. They, you know, some people had been at the club, and so they were in, you know, a variety of dress because of it. I mean, some people had taken off their shirts to make tourniquets and things like that. So there were, you know, it was an unusual looking crowd.
One of the first things they did to identify patients was put an email address up in the room. They asked friends and family to send photos of their loved ones. Those emails flooded Amy DeYoung's inbox. She spent that day printing photos out and walking around the ER with the pictures and information, trying to match up patients.
I found it difficult to even think about stopping because the emails weren't stopping. It was over 300 emails. And I felt like any second that I stop and I don't print these and take them to the cops is another minute. This person is in total anguish. I could hear the screaming, the blood-curdling screaming every time they would pull someone into another room next to my office and tell them that they were dead. And you just never forget that sound. It is horrible. I mean, it's one of those things that just never, I don't know that it'll ever leave my mind, that sound, just wrenching. And to see someone on their hands and knees telling us, you know, you're lying, there's no way he's dead. And you plow through it because you think, one of these is going to be alive and I'm going to be able to give somebody some good news. You know, and there were a couple where I could say, they're here, I can't tell you anything, but please call the front desk, you know, and those were the good ones.
But as the morning wore on, the reality of the shooting became apparent.
At one point, walked in the emergency room with a stack of photographs and heard one officer say to another one, they just breached the building and there's more bodies. And they said, I think there's over 30. When I heard that, I realized that I was probably holding photographs of people that were gone. And
I'm sorry.
I didn't have a response for those people that were freaking out, you know, that were really scared and looking for, you know, their father, their husbands, their wives, their mom. That was a tough one.
Law enforcement wasn't keen to tell families who was in the hospital because it was an active investigation. Holly Stewart again.
We really pushed the fact that we need to tell people who we've got here.
They told law enforcement that come 11 a.m., they were going to start telling family members who was inside the hospital. So Dr. Joseph Ibrahim, one of the trauma surgeons, stood in front of the crowd in the family room and began reading the names.
Frederick Johnson, he is stable. Felipe Sanchez, critical. Michael Morales, stable. Jose Diaz Ubiles, stable. Elmer Pacheco, stable.
You can hear the emotion. You can hear the emotion of someone hearing a name that they've been waiting several hours to hear, but it may be connected with a condition that they don't want to hear, because we actually said whether they were in critical, guarded, or good condition. And so you hear all of those emotions, and you'll hear all the cell phones going off in the background too.
Elka Reyes, critical. Paula Blanco, stable. Jose F. Martinez, critical. Angela Colon, stable.
Logistically, what we did was he read two lists. He read a list of patients who were doing well at Florida Hospital with just the names. And then he read the list and the conditions of the people that we had. And we actually said to the people in the room, if you heard a name at Florida Hospital, go to that corner. If you heard a name in good condition, go to that. Guarded,
critical. And then the clinical teams took those people away. And that's, I think, when it hit everyone, how many people we were dealing with that were going to be getting really, really bad news. We let them know that we still had several to identify. You know, in the back of my mind, I knew that we only had four, but we still probably had 100 people in the room. And you could see them kind of start processing the reality of it. Okay, you know, it's been 6 or 7 hours. They've read the list of who they know they have. I haven't heard from my person, but I can, you know, I can remember them staring back at us like, what about mine?
By afternoon, they moved the families to a Hampton Inn near the hospital campus. Dr. Jamal Hakeem was tasked with reading another list of names. He's standing on a chair, reading to a room full of people packed shoulder to shoulder. It looks hot in the video, and the people are noticeably frustrated.
So that's just a list of folks who are doing well at Florida Hospital. Okay. All right. Listen up. Okay. We are done. Here comes the other list.
Off camera, a woman faints.
Guys, have a clearer pass. They come in.
By evening time, the initial names of those who died in the club became public, and the families were moved out of the hospital to Camping World Stadium. Coming up, what we can learn from the Pulse nightclub shooting and how healthcare workers in Orlando help prepare doctors in Las Vegas. I'm Abe Abaraya, and you're listening to a special documentary from WMFE in Orlando. This is Pulse, Chaos in the ER. 44 victims came to Orlando Regional Medical Center June 12th. 36 came in the first 36 minutes. 9 of them died. There were 28 surgeries done in the first 24 hours. The most common surgery was an exploratory laparotomy, where the stomach is open to look for injuries. More than 17,000 surgical supplies were used. By the time the last patient was discharged nearly 3 months later, 550 units of blood were given. So what lessons can be learned from inside the ER during the Pulse nightclub shooting? What can it teach healthcare providers and first responders? And were those lessons used in Las Vegas, which took over Orlando's mantle as the site of the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history? Eric Alberts, the Director of Emergency Preparedness at Orlando Health, keeps a thick binder with him, 2 to 3 inches at least.
Well, the binder is actually what we've learned since Pulse. It includes personal notes, it includes our after-action report, it includes our corrective actions, it includes our PowerPoint that we do or show to other hospital organizations.
There are plenty of lessons to be learned from Pulse.
I think the being prepared for an active shooter, being, you know, drilling for that, practicing for that.
That's Dr. Chad Smith.
But also to sponsor or encourage an environment where your employees are empowered to do what they need to do.
This idea may need to be de-jargoned, so let's get some real-life examples from nurses Liz Burrows and Libby Brown.
Giving of the blood products.
Yeah,
we didn't wait to go run looking for doctors. This was, we knew they were bleeding. Mm-hmm. Their blood pressure's low. They need blood. Mm-hmm. So give the blood. I know that I started handing pain medicine to patients. I started giving them pain medicine because they need it, and I'm not going to let them sit there and suffer. So I know those for me were the things that I'm just like, usually we
would ask
the doctor.
Right. You're
it just needed
order.
To be done. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And most, I mean, and then after that, we were kind of going through and giving people antibiotics and, you know, tetanus shots. And it, there's, you know, we were following within our protocols and that kind of thing, but we weren't checking with anybody or, you know, that kind of thing. Nurses were going independently with patients to CT that were, you know, unstable and things like that. We would have 2-3 doctors going with us, but there just wasn't enough. So, you know, luckily we have enough experienced nurses in the trauma room, and we've seen enough that people were able to take responsibility kind of for those patients and be confident that, you know, they could handle what was going on, you know, more independently. So,
one area where the hospital learned a number of lessons, how to deal with the families that show up. Amy DeYoung, who worked during the shooting to try and identify victims, says one solution needs to be technological.
And definitely more use of technology. And that's one of the things we're working on right now is how do we have a website for uploading photographs and a one single email address that's not someone's, some individual's, that can be pulled from nonstop and updated by the community. And then we can update it internally and show and share with the law enforcement.
Her boss, Holly Stewart, says the hospital learned that the family room isn't just a place.
When we have drilled for this in the past, the family room is really a geographic location and some creature comforts. We say, okay, we're going to put them in the North Tower lobby, and we're going to put water and blankets in there, and we now know that there's a whole lot more to it. And so the counselors that I talked about, you know, we needed our chaplains, we needed grief counselors, we needed Spanish interpreters, we needed medical attention. So be thinking about, you know, the emotional, psychological, and physical needs of the people that are in the room, not just the actual room and some creature comforts.
You know, I think one of the most visible changes to the hospital is, you know, the changes, and I imagine this would be something you have considered about in guest services. You know, when you come to the hospital now, you know, there are security guards, you have to go through a metal detector, you know, before you're able to come in, and that's from Pulse.
That's from Pulse, and it's part of the realization that public places like hospitals have to be more vigilant now than we did in the past. And I think, you know, from a guest perspective, people are accustomed to that now. I mean, you can't get on a plane like you used to be able to get onto. You can't go to a lot of places. You can't go to the arena without, you know, ensuring that, you know, we're keeping safe. Some of it, too, is the psychological safety for our team. And, you know, a lot of effort has gone into making sure our team is okay. And that is clearly one of the things that they see every single day that reminds them that we're doing everything that we can to keep our team safe too.
Dr. Michael Cheatham says hospitals have to get ready for events like Pulse. Every hospital, small community hospitals, rural hospitals, big trauma centers, it doesn't matter. Orlando Regional Medical Center got most of the shooting victims. And that's not because they were the level one trauma center. They got them because they were three blocks away.
We've been amazed as we have spoken at conferences how many hospitals do not have a disaster plan. You just can't, in today's environment, with as many mass shootings as we've seen, you cannot not have a plan. And so that's the first thing, encouraging everyone to have a plan. The second thing that we have decided is going to be our emphasis is teaching the public what we call stop the bleed.
Stop the bleed is basically the same thing as teaching people CPR. If someone's bleeding, it teaches the basics until first responders make it to the scene.
This is a national initiative. It actually was first proposed about a year ago, or about a year before Pulse, and came out of the Sandy Hook massacre, where all the school children were killed.
Orlando Health also got a crash course in mental health care for their own employees. They did critical incident debriefings, offered individual counseling sessions, and made chaplains available for employees. 1,200 employees have accessed these services. It strikes me that every single person I talked to had that moment when the adrenaline kicked off and they had to process what happened. For Amy DeYoung, who spent the day identifying victims, it was when she was all alone in her driveway.
I remember pulling into my driveway and the sun was just going down, and I lived in probably East Orlando for many, many years, but had probably lived in my current location for maybe a year and a half, something like that. And it's literally out in the country, and so it's very quiet now. When I opened my car door and I got out, and all I could hear were trees and through the wind and the and birds, and just dead silence. And all I could think about was that's the silence. That's the silence of those lives that are gone. And I thought about when I went home, there were people that still didn't know where their loved ones were, and they knew they weren't in the hospital.
But there's this pray to God that, are they that one that wasn't identified that's in our hospital? And I just felt horrible, absolutely horrible for those friends and family that were wondering and trying to go to sleep and sick to their stomachs. And I felt safe where I was because I realized it was in the country. And I was like, you know, I didn't realize how unsafe I felt in the city at that moment. Being there and being part of the LGBT community, you wonder, is this the beginning of something? Or was this an isolated incident? And then you're just that feeling of, okay, I'm physically safe, but oh my God, these people, what has just happened here?
The experience changed her.
I've never felt more safe in a public place than I have at my own job. And the feeling of acceptance and to see surgeons, and the first people to wear a rainbow ribbon on their chest was a heterosexual resident. And I asked someone the next morning, where are you getting that rainbow ribbon from? Oh, it's one of the residents. I couldn't believe it. Next thing I know, my heterosexual coworkers are cutting ribbons and wearing them. And it took me a couple days to get comfortable to put that on. I see them on Dr. Oz, the surgeons with the rainbow ribbons. I don't know that anybody in that group really understands the impact they have on us when they wear those. There's a feeling of no shame again, and safety. And acceptance and love. And I mean, I could not be any more proud to be part of that group of individuals, not just for the lives they saved, but for the way they made the community feel afterwards. Yeah, very proud of them.
Could you imagine something like this, that kind of support, when you were younger?
No, absolutely not. No. As a matter of fact, I remember how small our parade used to be. The first time I went to an LGBT pride parade in downtown Orlando, I was faced with three KKK members and their white, whatever it is they wear. And that was my reminder that there's some people that really hate you, Amy, and there's violence out there. And at the time, you know, I think Matthew Shepard passed away shortly after that was his murder. And that's when I really started to realize people actually are being killed for when they're out in the open.
Has it changed your outlook on, you know, anything political? Have you changed how you view things or how you are advocating?
Let me just say, yes, I've never been an advocate. I've always kind of stuck around in the background. I'm a little more vocal, and I'm a little bit more apt to stand up for myself in terms of that, the LGBT community and rights, and explaining things to people just out of their own ignorance, not understanding something. I'm a little more apt to do that now. In the past, I would have stepped back a little bit in the background, and I can tell you it's not for me. It's for them. Their faces, those individuals, their 49 people's faces plastered together forever, all of eternity, to say these folks died in an LGBT bar. And you know what? A handful of them are heterosexual. And they're grouped together with us. And I'm happy to say they're part of us, that they were supportive of us that night. One of them was a mother and was there supporting her son. And so I just don't feel it's my right anymore to stand back and not admit it if someone wants to ask or was to say, hey, or, oh, you're married? What's his name? Oh, no, her name is Carla. It's my wife. but I don't feel like I have the right to lie anymore. I think that's the biggest thing.
Orlando Regional Medical Center workers have been touring the country giving talks about the Pulse nightclub shooting. They've done 6 of those talks in Las Vegas, including one doctor who spoke to University Medical Center Las Vegas. That's the Level 1 trauma center that got hundreds of victims from the most recent shooting. After Las Vegas took over Orlando's mantle as the site of the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history, ORMC's Dr. Joseph Ibrahim and Eric Albert spoke with reporters.
We talked very intently about the Stop the Bleed campaign, which some of you may be aware of, which is the national initiation by the American College of Surgeons to train the communities on how to respond when such an event occurs. In other words, how to put on tourniquets, how to hold pressure, which hopefully some of the individuals there last night had some of that training and utilized that to save some lives. Because in events like that, you have extremity wounds in addition to other wounds, but you know, the goal of that campaign is that nobody should bleed to death from a gunshot wound, say to the arm or leg.
So they got a surge of a very large amount of people in a very short time frame. And also in looking at their maps, it seems like the hospitals are farther than, you know, Pulse was to ORMC, so that really goes back to the level of care being provided back to the patients The longer the time of the traumatic injury, as you can attest to, the worse it is for that patient. So, you know, again, just a lot of concern for the patients there, a lot of different injuries or different types of injuries, and there's a lot they're going to have to contend with in a very short time frame. And it's not going to go away anytime soon.
Albert says there are many changes at Orlando Health after Pulse.
You know, the number one issue with any kind of emergency or exercise is communications. It always is. And for us, we still have the need for the mass notification system, and we're hopefully going to have that by the end of this year. So that way we're able to notify all of our team members when something bad like this happens. It's very challenging on a normal day to communicate in a big organization like this, but during a crisis, it makes it even more difficult. So you have to take additional preparedness steps, and you have to do additional plans to help make sure people get the proper communication. It's very challenging.
And we don't have that notification system yet. It's something you're still working on.
Something we're still working on, yeah. Another one was, you know, to build out our MCI surge carts that we have at ORMC.
That's the mass casualty incident surgical carts brought out during big incidents.
With some of the supplies that we identified we needed. So extra chest tubes, monitor cables, surgical supplies, those types of things, we had to go back and resupply and update our policy on that.
Is there any amount of drilling or training that can really prepare a hospital for 500 plus people?
I mean, and drilling is the key, and I've heard Eric say it before. You know, you can't just do the tabletop drills and, you know, make it a game. It's not a board game, right? You have to get the people in the right spots, which is why we do the drills the way we do. Actually talk about your roles. And a lot of times you do that when the event comes around, they may not know exactly what to do, but they'll be in the right spot to put them, you know, give them the ability to do what needs to be done. So that's really the important part of doing the drilling and the mass casualty preparedness kind of thing. But to be prepared for 500, yeah, I don't know if anybody could be prepared for something like that. I'm sure they have regional trauma networks and things like that, we're gonna make room by sending the less acutely ill to a hospital maybe 20, 30 miles away. And we have steps like that in place. We have some other centers that we could utilize if we had to in those kind of situations.
Ibrahim said the words of encouragement they got during Pulse were a boost. Here's what he would say to the workers in Las Vegas.
Just that we're all thinking about you. We have been somewhat in their situation, not to this scale, but that we are definitely thinking about them, praying for them, and that, lean on each other. And this is a long, long, drawn-out process. It's not going to be immediate, so they have to take care of each other.
Those working during the Pulse nightclub shooting have spent the last 14 months teaching others what went right and what went wrong in the hospital. Now, as Las Vegas becomes the site of the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history, it'll be their turn to share lessons learned. I'm Abe Abaraya, and you've been listening to Pulse, Chaos in the ER from WMFE in Orlando.